Penguin Random House Audio presents Head First, How the Mind Heals the Body by Alistair Santhouse. Read for you by Nathaniel Priestley, with an epilogue read by the author. Neither the publisher nor the author is engaged in rendering professional advice or services to the individual reader. The ideas, procedures, and suggestions contained in this book are not intended as a substitute for consulting with your physician. All matters regarding your health require medical supervision. Neither the author nor the publisher shall be liable or responsible for any loss or damage allegedly arising from any information or suggestion in this book. The stories chronicled in this book are based on many years of practice. However, maintaining patient confidentiality is of utmost importance, so the author has taken care to remove any identifying clinical or personal information. Some of the case studies are an amalgam of several patients. Ask not what disease the person has, but rather what person the disease has. Sir William Osler, 1849 to 1919. Journey. I remember Roland well, although I met him only twice. In fact, I heard him before I saw him. I was startled by an alarming noise, somewhere between a cough and a snort, as I approached the waiting room on my return from lunch to start an afternoon clinic. I sat down with him in my consulting room, and he told me his story. Age 33, he was from Gabon, unmarried, and had come to the UK 3 years earlier. Since his arrival, he had experienced increasing discomfort with his throat, resulting in frequent explosive exhalations. His regular doctor had been unable to make a diagnosis, and had rather unusually, rather than referring him to a single specialist for an opinion, made 3 separate referrals. Roland had found life in the UK difficult. He had struggled to find work, had no family here, and was unable to see his daughter, who lived with an ex-partner in Gabon. His symptoms had begun several years before and were now worse than ever. As he snorted and spluttered, I found myself distracted by a persistent urge to clean my desk with an antiseptic wipe. It was with some difficulty that I listened to his story. He had been encouraged by friends to see his doctor, who, reading between the lines, hadn't initially worried about his symptoms, but had subsequently referred him to the hospital for more opinions. It was clear to me that the cumulative stress and disappointment in Roland's life had exacerbated a nervous tic, which was now so deeply ingrained in his motor system as to be automatic. I had seen symptoms like this before, in which unusual movements and behaviours, rehearsed often enough, become hardwired. For example, I've seen people present with a strange gait that makes walking unnatural and effortful, seemingly without any deliberate simulation, even when there is nothing wrong with their muscles or nerves. Sometimes patients experience persistent pain or dizziness, or can speak only in a whisper, without there being any identifiable physiological cause, even after months or years of medical investigations. The ways in which patients present are as plentiful as the number of symptoms. When I treat such patients, I acknowledge that these illnesses, even if they have no clear-cut physical cause, are not made up or simulated. They are as real as any other illness, even if their cause is believed to be psychological. It is difficult to know why an individual will have a particular symptom. For instance, paralysis rather than dizziness or speaking in a whisper. Back in the early 1900s, some psychiatrists believed that an individual's symptoms carried a symbolic significance. For example, someone who witnessed an appalling event might develop blindness. Although this sort of belief is still occasionally mentioned in psychiatry textbooks, not many people believe it. In Roland's case, his symptoms began with a cough and a sore throat, but his persistent focus on his breathing developed into a preoccupation. His cousin told him that he must have been cursed, an idea that Roland felt was being fulfilled in the shape of serious illness. This worry served only to perpetuate his symptoms, until coughing and exhaling noisily through his nose was as natural to him as breathing. Such presentations are often known as conversion disorders, referring to the theory that psychological stresses are converted into physical symptoms, although it should be acknowledged that there is little consensus on what such presentations should be called. Our disorganized classification system is a reflection of the different ways in which people have understood these symptoms over the years. Some diagnoses, such as conversion disorder, stem from the theory of Freudian psychoanalysis, while other diagnoses, such as persistent physical symptoms, are descriptive, yet both might be talking about the same thing. The term functional disorder is commonly used to indicate that while the structures of the body, the nerves, muscles, and organs, are all intact, their function is impaired. Sometimes the terms used are pejorative or insulting, a heart sink patient, referring to the effect they have on a doctor's morale, a fat folder, used to describe the thickness of a patient's notes, and yet others such as supratentorial, pointing to a region of the brain, while respectful and medical-sounding, suggest that the cause lies in the brain and are a wink to fellow professionals that the doctor thinks it is all psychiatric. As I dictated my letter to Roland's GP, I picked up his file and two letters fell out. The first was from an ear, nose and throat, ENT, specialist, who had diagnosed a problem with his vocal cords. The second was from a neurologist, who had diagnosed a disorder of the nervous system. I began to worry. Had I completely misread the situation? I wondered whether to commit my diagnosis to the notes, my confidence in it steadily waning. I knew the ENT and neurology consultants to be sharp and capable doctors, not the sort who were casual about diagnoses. My diagnosis seemed even less sound when Roland came back to see me some weeks later, smiling and relieved that his symptoms had all but gone. It turned out that, lacking any confidence in his trio of physicians, he had laid out all his cares to a sympathetic priest, who agreed with him that he must have been cursed and administered holy water, thereby effecting this miraculous cure. I felt chastened. Roland had seen four healers, each of whom had reached a conclusion based on our understanding of the human body or mind. We had all seen what we wanted to see. The ENT specialist found a problem with the vocal cords, the neurologist found a problem with his nerves, the psychiatrist found a problem with his mind, and the priest with his soul. I found this unsettling. I had always believed that the way I saw things was the way that they were. Medicine is narrow like that. We tend not to question our beliefs. In all medical textbooks, there is a formula for presenting an illness. It starts with epidemiology, how common the illness is. The etiology, what is considered its cause. Its presentation, how the illness looks to the doctor. Its course, what the natural history of the illness might be if it is left untreated. And its prognosis, outcome. Treatments that alter the natural prognosis are discussed, and man triumphs over nature. I have taught medical students in teaching hospitals throughout my career. They believe that all symptoms are the product of a disease, which should be investigated and a cure offered. This process becomes second nature to medical students during their training and therefore goes unchallenged. There is an implicit belief that anything else is not real medicine. When I try to teach them a different way of thinking, they at first look slightly skeptical and then unsettled. I explain to them that symptoms are part of life and that most of the time, tiredness, pain, dizziness, or backache don't indicate any disease at all. Good doctors realize this, and a significant part of their role is to judge which symptoms to investigate and which to ignore. But mainstream medical thought and public opinion disagree with my hypothesis. Symptoms are seen as indicative of illness, based on the prevalent infectious disease model of medicine that is practiced in the West. In this model, an infectious agent is identified, an antibiotic or other cure is developed to attack the infectious agent, and a cure is effected. Treatment of infectious disease was the first major success of modern medicine, as dogma and superstition began to be replaced by a more evidence-based approach.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?